Before I begin my sermon this morning, let me share an interesting coincidence. Yesterday I was at the retreat, the EU Montana retreat, and one of the people from the region who was here from Denver shared with me that a man who had been in sanctuary at the Denver church was deported just yesterday. Pretty emotional for him. So I find it really interesting that today I'm preaching on immigration, and we have a story about someone who didn't get deported. When I was a youth, it seemed like all the adults in my community knew everyone who lived in town as well as all the farmers who lived in the surrounding countryside. I say that because no matter where I was or who was around, if I did something I wasn't supposed to, my parents always knew about it before I got Growing up in such a community had its advantages and its disadvantages. I always had the sense that I would be protected and sheltered from harm. Most of the time, I was sheltered from the harsh realities of life. Realities that I now realize were important for me to become aware of. Realities such as immigration-related issues and deportation of people who don't have the proper papers. But there were times when the community's usual way of life would be disrupted. For a few months every year, there would be an influx of strangers to the community. The strangers looked and acted very differently than almost everyone I knew. Their skin was darker than mine, and the way they dressed wasn't like that of anyone that I knew who lived in the community. Not only that, they spoke a language that I couldn't understand, and neither could any of the adults I knew. It was obvious these people were outsiders. These people were migrant laborers who would work and come every year to the fields. The migrant laborers weren't just men, whole families came. Wives and children worked in the fields along with husbands and fathers. They lived in what were commonly called migrant shacks, because that was what they looked like, shacks. They were square, one-room buildings with no running water and a single incandescent light hanging in the middle of the room. Now remember, this was over 50 years ago, but there are still places like that. There was no privacy, and sometimes two or three families would have to share one shack. Most of those who came were from Mexico. They would begin arriving in June, just a few of them. By August, though, there were hundreds of them. That was a lot for a county with a population of less than 35,000. Then, once the crops were harvested in September, they would all disappear. They'd be gone. From the time I was young, I could tell that the people of the community didn't like these strangers. I could tell it by the looks on people's faces and by the way they would speak about these visitors, but they wouldn't speak to them. The message most evident in the community was that the people who had come in to work the fields weren't appreciated, and they weren't welcome. Before I reached my teens, I had learned the mannerisms of disdain and the disparaging words that were so often used by the people I knew. I used the mannerisms and the words myself back then. These strangers somehow deserved to be treated poorly, or at least that's what I thought. They were using up the limited local services in the area and taking job opportunities from the people in the community. But like so many things I believed earlier in my life, I came to discover that not all that I was taught was right or true. My discovery began the summer after I turned 14. By that time, my two older sisters had their driver's licenses. I was beginning to fantasize about getting my license and being able to drive whenever I wanted to. But there was a problem. Unless I could somehow buy my own car, I would be relegated to fourth in line for use of the family vehicle. Fourth. I was desperate to earn money and begin saving. The only means of transportation I had available to get to a job were my 2 feet and a one-speed bicycle with wide tires. Neither of these would get me very far, and both were a slow way to go. Then, a friend told me of a great opportunity. 6 days a week, a farm truck would come to a local bank parking lot, by local, I mean just a couple blocks from my home, and pick up anyone who wanted to work in the fields. You know, it seemed like that was exactly what I was looking for. Seemed like an incredible deal. It sounded too good to be true. And of course it was. In order to get the ride, you had to be on the truck by 6 in the morning. And it didn't bring you back until 6 that evening, or sometimes even later. If the weather was really hot and sunny, or if it rained cats and dogs, you were out in it all day. As much as I wanted to earn money that summer, I could never quite seem to get myself up and moving in time and ready to catch that bus. Several of my friends had claimed they were going to ride the truck and work in the fields that summer. I later learned that not one of them ever did so. There was more I discovered as well. If you took the truck to the fields, you earned money the way the migrant laborers did, by how much you picked, not by how long you worked. If you weren't really speedy, you could work all day and only make a few dollars. While the wage requirements have changed over the years and the pay is still very low, and the work is dirty and physically demanding. I know because I spent summers when I was 16 and 17 working in the fields, weeding beans and pickles and baling straw and hay. But I got paid by the hour. Being paid by the hour meant that when I would stop to take a break, I was still getting paid. By the time I graduated from high school, I'd come to realize that without all those people who worked in the fields, many of the local farmers wouldn't be able to harvest their crops. Without the cheap labor, they wouldn't be able to afford to farm. Over the years, a number of the farmers I knew had to sell their farms or lost their lands, not because of anything involving migrant laborers, but because of the fluctuations of crop prices. Farming, you see, is a tough way to make a living. whether a person works on the farm or owns it. When I was young, those who migrated to work in the fields would typically return to their home countries for several months a year. That was long before we began fortifying our borders. Today, most of the people who come seeking such work go to great lengths to get into this country. The 2011-2012 National Agricultural Workers Survey found that of the approximately 2.5 million farm workers, almost half don't have proper legal documentation to be here. And that's just farm laborers. Today, most of these people don't return to their native country out of fear of being caught when attempting to return here as they seek to provide for themselves and their families. Some people say these people need to abide by the law of our land and should only be here after going through the proper channels and obtaining the necessary paperwork. That sounds reasonable until you begin to look into the specific requirements within immigration law. When you look into the details, it very quickly becomes evident why the immigration system is not working. It's obviously not working for those who want to immigrate, but it is also not working for the employers these immigrants work for. These employers are put in the position of breaking the law when they hire a person who doesn't have the proper paperwork to be in this country legally. And what about the undocumented person and the employer? How are they treated if they're discovered by the authorities? Being in the country without proper documentation and hiring such a person are both considered civil offenses. Civil, different than criminal. Neither is considered a criminal act, yet the employer is required to pay a fine for the civil offense they commit, and the undocumented worker is typically immediately put in detention, provided minimal opportunity for legal review, and eventually deported. Sometimes after weeks or months of being locked up. Once they've been deported, there is no possibility for them to legally immigrate. Now, I've been focusing primarily on those who feel compelled to come here for economic reasons, but there are a variety of reasons that people seek to immigrate. Some people want to be here with family members who are residents or citizens of our country. Others are fleeing from war or combat in their homelands. Some are members of groups that are persecuted in their home countries. And there are those who no longer want to live under oppressive regimes and want to live instead in a land where freedom and justice are highly valued. And there are others as well. I could go on and on. All the ones that I've mentioned seem to me to be reasonable motivations for wanting to come to this country. I find all of these reasons congruent with our UU principles. Because of how I understand our principles, as a delegate at the 2010 UUA General Assembly, I voted in favor of a proposed congregational study action issue titled Immigration as a Moral Issue. The issue was approved by a significant majority. Since then, I've made it a point to educate myself and others further on this topic. If you are interested in learning more about the immigration issue, I encourage you to go to the UUA website and review the study guide titled Immigration as a Moral Issue. From what I have learned, it is clear to me that our current immigration laws and policies, as well as the prevailing sentiment in our country, convey a message that was so prevalent in the community of my youth. Strangers are not welcome here. Those who are from foreign lands and are struggling will find little, if any, compassion for their plight in our immigration system. I believe the immigration situation in our country today provides us, all of us, an opportunity to look at what we consider to be important and at what we value. The hometown I grew up in provided me with the safety, the stability, and the security I needed to become the person I am. The migrant laborers who came each summer and the immigrants I later came to know provided me the opportunity to recognize that while safety, stability, and security are important, there are other things that are just as important, and I believe quite probably even more so. These are the things that have been spoken of by spiritual teachers for centuries. In the book of Matthew, we find that Jesus responded to the question, "What is the highest commandment?" with, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." The Buddha, who recognized that suffering is a part of everyone's life, instructed those who came to him seeking the path to enlightenment to develop and demonstrate compassion for everyone they would encounter. Let me repeat that, for everyone they would encounter. I don't claim to have the answer of how to solve the current problems regarding immigration. I know that safety, stability, and security are important to and for everyone. I also know that love and compassion are important. What seems clear to me is that when our interest in safety, stability, and security supersedes our capacity to show love and compassion, our humanity is diminished and the world becomes a bit more impoverished. My hope, yes, my desire, is that we, all of us, can somehow find a way to consider those who seek to live in this country as our neighbor, and that we can someday learn to love our neighbor as ourselves and to show compassion to everyone we encounter. May it be so.